There are some images that, once seen, can't be forgotten. Earlier this month, the lifeless body of a young Syrian toddler washed up on the beach of a Turkish resort town. The photograph of him, with his dark hair and his bright red t-shirt and shorts, has become the symbol of refugees fleeing Syria. I'm Anne Strangehamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, we're talking about the moral value of photography during times of war and human crisis. Do images of pain and suffering foster empathy and compassion, or do they do something else? The late Susan Sontag spent her entire life asking these questions. She wrote a classic book on the subject called Regarding the Pain of Others, and she told Steve Paulson that graphic war photos can be very powerful, but also very complicated, and they can have unintended consequences.
All war photography is susceptible, available to being used for organizing against war. But I don't think it has to have that impact at all, because I think in certain contexts you see these images as, look at the terrible things the enemy is doing to us. We must fight even harder to repel the enemy. I think to a Palestinian, looking at images of the destruction of the center of the refugee camp in Jenin, these are not anti-war images. These are images which promote militancy.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you point out that many of the classic war photographs over the decades were actually staged. I mean, going back to Matthew Brady during the Civil War, a lot of those pictures of dead bodies were rearranged to make them look especially graphic, I guess you could say. And other classic photos were staged as well. The American soldiers planting the flag at Iwo Jima. That was a recreation of an actual event.
Well, you know, I think that the understanding of photography almost from the beginning was that it was something that was posed. To begin with, it was because exposure time was quite lengthy by our standards. It could be up to 15 seconds in certain light conditions, as long as a minute. So it was understood that photographs were posed. And I think the notion that photographs should be of an absolutely unguarded moment, as if the photographer is a spy catching something, an event or situation or person, unaware of being observed, is a much later notion. You mentioned the iconic World War II photograph of the raising of the flag in Iwo Jima. Now, of course, there was a raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. It happened in the morning. The photographer, who was an army photographer, had people perform the event again, soldiers, later in the afternoon, with a much bigger flag. That's the interesting detail. If you actually look at the flag in that famous picture, it does seem awfully big for soldiers to be carrying around. And, of course, it makes a much handsomer picture.
Does that bother you? I mean, doesn't that seem wrong to do something
like that? Oh, I think
it
bothers everybody. But the standard that a picture should not be tampered with, I think that's been slow in evolving. Now I think people would be extremely intolerant of that kind of thing. But there are two pivotal moments, I think, in the history of war photography. One is the Spanish Civil War, where for the first time a war was covered by photojournalists, most famously Robert Capa, who had cameras that were portable. Before that, photography was basically the camera on a tripod. So the photographer was not going into the thick of battle. But once the portable Leica and film that could shoot 36 images before reloading was developed, you had the photographer going into battle and producing images which really set the standard for what war photography could be. That was, on the whole, very partisan photography. The famous images from the Spanish Civil War are all from photojournalists who were on one side, namely the Republican side. They were against the fascist rebellion led by Franco, which did, in fact, triumph. In the Vietnam War, I think that was a second turning point, where, again, most all of the photography was taken by partisan people who sympathized with the sufferings of the Vietnamese and of the American soldiers, and they were not for the war. And a lesson was learned from the Vietnam War by governments making war that one must not let the photojournalists have free rein.
And you don't see that anymore. I mean, in the first Persian Gulf War, there are very few pictures of actual combat.
Actually, the model for that was in an even earlier war, a small war waged by Prime Minister Thatcher. And when the British Expeditionary Force was dispatched to Argentina to recapture some islands off Argentina that the British owned, Thatcher essentially forbade journalistic coverage or controlled it so thoroughly. They have virtually no battle scenes or scenes of the carnage and the deaths that were caused in that war.
Now, you mentioned Vietnam, and the ethics get really complicated. And for instance, there's a famous picture, I think it was in 1968, of a South Vietnamese policeman shooting a Viet Cong suspect. And the picture is, I mean, it's unforgettable. It's the moment of death as the bullet is entering the body. But apparently that was, in a sense, staged as well. I mean, that policeman waited for the journalist to assemble before he executed this guy.
That's right. And people often say, well, why doesn't the photographer intervene? You know, photographers are very often accused of being voyeurs, of photographing something when perhaps they could have prevented it from happening. I think that that's a very unfair accusation because in these situations, I don't think the photographer could prevent the event. Maybe I shouldn't say photographers. The public for war photography obviously particularly prizes and finds particularly memorable photographs taken at the moment of death. It's like a whole separate category of war photographs. There's a fabulous example, totally memorable. It's three photographs taken by Tyler Hicks, a marvelous photojournalist who covered the war in Afghanistan in late 2001 for the New York Times. And he shows in three photographs, kind of triptych, the murder of a captured Taliban soldier, a wounded soldier, actually, who's been dragged out of a ditch. He's already wounded, very severely wounded, and is then butchered by advancing Northern Alliance soldiers. And it's absolutely horrible images to look at. Now, what do you feel when you look at that? One's feelings are, I think, are so complicated, Steve, because I mean, who of us is sympathetic to the Taliban? How can we be sympathetic to the Taliban? It's one of the most atrocious and despotic movements in modern history.
But there is another side to this.
But this is a human being.
I mean,
this is a human being.
It's a human being. It's horrible. I don't think anyone can look at those kinds of pictures without feeling horror. But yet, on the other hand, there is a certain thrill. I mean, it's the dirty little secret about what we're talking about. There's a kind of voyeuristic appeal to seeing some of the carnage at times, not always, but at times. It's the reason why, you know, we often slow down as we're driving by a car wreck to try to catch a glimpse of what happened.
It's absolutely true that there is a voyeuristic impulse in many people, in most people, and they will slow down to look at the car wreck and then say, wasn't that terrible? We are attracted in some way to these images. The basis on which we're attracted is rather complicated. Maybe it's that we want to experience that we are safe. You see, if I can go back to the idea of the whole book regarding the pain of others, what does the title mean? It means we are safe, and we are looking at something happening to other people, but we're not there. We're here. We're here looking at a magazine or a newspaper. We're in front of our television sets. We're looking at images on our computer. And the terrible things are happening somewhere else. So why do we want to look at them? First of all, we think we ought to look at them, maybe. We have an obligation to look at them, to know what the world is really like. Maybe we have a particular identification with this struggle or a particular interest in it. Maybe we're testing ourselves to see if we really can look at terrible things, like a kind of ordeal. But I think in all of these experiences, something is happening, which I think is real at the same time, very questionable, that it's there and it's not here, and if you're just looking at it, you're not responsible.
In a sense, it removes us from the suffering. And I don't want to overplay this, but we can perhaps feel a little more virtuous by going through the pain of looking at these, but yet also in the back of our minds, we know that's not us. I mean, we're safe. We're innocent.
One, it's not happening to us, and two, we're not doing it. Now, the second assertion may be a little questionable. I mean, if your country has gone to war with another country, do you have a responsibility to oppose that war? I think that the images tend to make us feel passive, but I don't think, as I used to think, that they necessarily desensitize us. I think they only desensitize us when we're told this is an age-old conflict, there's absolutely nothing to be done about it, it's hopeless. Then I think you have, you know, say, oh, that again, and you switch the channel. But if you have been told that something can happen, something can be different, if you have another political context, I think these images can be very mobilizing, and I don't think you get used to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I think we tend to feel these days that given the reach of the modern media, that we see everything. We see all the horrors, but that's actually not true. I mean, we don't
see
the worst of it. Going back to the September 11th attacks, we saw repeatedly the plane smashing into the World Trade Center. We saw almost no images of dead bodies. And you know, clearly, they were there, but people chose not to show those.
Yes, there was a great deal of largely self-censorship, which of course is the most powerful form of censorship, of the images of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. There are virtually no images of the destruction of the Pentagon and of the people who were killed there. And there were a lot of photographs that were taken, this is well known, of very gruesome things at the World Trade Center. And what was the reason that the people who control the media gave about this? This isn't helpful. Or something you hear very often, this is not in good taste. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very suspicious when people talk about good taste as a reason for not showing something. It's felt to be unpatriotic. It's felt to be demoralizing. There are all sorts of reasons.
Well, the other reason that's often given is it would be disrespectful to the families of the dead, that somehow it would be dishonoring the memory.
Yes, but that's because Americans have the rather obscene habit of thinking that American lives are worth more than anybody else's lives, and American lives have an entirely different value than other people's lives. We don't have a problem about showing foreign dead. We have a problem showing American dead. Mm.
And it is true that you almost never see the face of a dead American.
Well, those Civil War photographs that were taken by the Brady team on the battlefields of Antietam and Gettysburg did show faces, and they were extremely shocking. They were really breaking a taboo. But by and large, notions of disrespect to survivors is a reason often given that we don't show bad things that happen to Americans. But we have no problem about showing bad things that happen to people abroad, particularly people in Asia or Africa, as if those people didn't have relatives and as if those people couldn't confront those images. I think, again, of the soldier, the Taliban soldier who's butchered in the Tyler Hicks pictures, I don't think it's unlikely that his family saw those images. People are online in Afghanistan. They have access to these images, but we don't think about that. Americans tend not to think about other people being human beings with families in the same way that we think about ourselves.
The late Susan Sontag talking with Steve Paulson about her last book, Regarding the Pain of Others. Some of the most disturbing and also compelling photographs of death that I've seen are by a photographer named Sarah Sudoff. If you see them from a distance on a gallery wall, you'd think they're abstracts. They're big prints with deep, rich reds and browns, blotchy, kind of organic shapes, but they're actually close-ups of bloodstains. Sarah calls the series At the Hour of Our Death. Sarah, do you have a favorite photograph from At the Hour of Our Death?
Yes, it's called Suicide with Gun, Female, 60 Years Old. It's actually a portion of a mattress bisected down the middle. There's stains all over it, but there's particularly some red splotches, and the mattress has now turned yellow from the stain of urine.
It's beautiful, as are all your photographs, but, well, I guess it's disturbing that they're beautiful. They're mm-hmm. beautiful and dark at the same time. Is that what you're aiming to do?
I think with this series, I'm very interested in getting under your skin a little bit. to raise questions in your mind, to make you curious, to make you possibly step back for a second. The few times that I have exhibited the work, if I can choose to, I don't often put the text or the title next to the piece. I just have the photograph up, so it's a little bit ambiguous as to what it is, drawing you in, the saturated color, the abstractness. Ideally, the prints are 30 by 40 inches. So the fragment or swatch that I'm photographing is very much enlarged from its actual size.
So you're not just looking at a photograph of a bloodstain. It's a gigantic, enlarged bloodstain.
Yes, it's about the size of me. I'm just over 5 feet tall, so it's close to my size and scale. And most of the material is quite small, a throw pillow or a portion of a mattress, like I said before, or a bed sheet. And then I'm using a macro lens and going in really tight and detailed on just a small section.
What does it feel like to be handling that stuff? I mean, what's your attitude while you're doing it? You're, you know, touching and photographing the cellular remains of someone mm-hmm. who died violently. A lot of people would find that terribly disturbing.
It is, and the camera provides a nice shield or provides a nice distance between you and what you're photographing. You can sort of hide behind it. But after a year of working on this project, it started to affect me a lot more. Initially, curiosity just took over. And then the longer that I've sat with it, the more that I've thought about it and talked about the work, it is a bit disturbing.
Do you feel, I don't know, a sense of reverence? Is there a way in which when you're handling some of these objects, they feel like sacred objects?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I am conscious that it is the cellular residue of someone. I don't know who this person is. I don't know anything more about them than, you know, possibly how they died. But I do feel that I need to be respectful. That's just a personal thing to me, that I'm being as careful as I can be.
I'm just thinking that so often in our culture, you know, we like to pretend that death doesn't happen or that it mm-hmm. can be tidy. And here you are asking us to confront, beautifully maybe, but still to confront death. What kind of reactions do you get from people who see your work?
It runs the whole gamut. A lot of people are moved by the work. I get a lot of people who think I'm exploiting the people who have died. For the most part, the responses have been very positive. People may find them beautiful in their abstract quality and not want to engage any further with the work. And then other people who do want to enter in and have a dialogue about death and dying and traces. We have a great conversation.
Why do you think this interest has stayed with you for so long?
I'm not sure. I have a few ideas. I come from a military family. And my father went to the Gulf War. When he came back, he showed me videos of what he saw and what it was like to be on the ground there. And, you know, whether or not a 13-year-old should see that, I was definitely exposed to it. I knew about war. I knew about how fragile our bodies were, coupled with the fact that I wanted to be a doctor when I was younger. With my experience with cervical cancer, that sort of interest in the medical realm with illness, with mortality, sort of opened back up and came back to the front.
What does your family think of your work?
My mother would like me to take pictures of dogs and cats and, you know, sunsets. I think my dad understands my work better than my mother. They both are appreciative and they're both supportive, but it is a challenge.
You have a new baby.
I do.
When he's old enough to see your work for the first time, what do you think you'll say to him about it? How will you explain it?
I guess the easiest way to talk about it is when I was an undergraduate, I attended a lecture by photojournalists, and they were talking about the role of the photographer and the role of the camera. They said that photographers are like flashlights. They bring light to the darkness. I've loved that idea of revealing something to the world that other people would rather not look at or possibly have looked over. So I guess I would tell my son that the projects that I work on are issues that most people wouldn't want to look at or think about, but that I feel are relevant and important to share with the world. I feel like I have a duty.
I'm curious, has there ever been a photo you've taken that's just been too much, too powerful, too raw?
My older project repository, when I was photographing in the hospital, I had never had access to a hospital like this before, and so was photographing anything. Yeah, I was very curious. And one day in the histology lab, the technician that I was working with mentioned that amputation had just occurred, and he pulled the leg out for me to look at. Of course, I was curious and wanted to look, and I photographed it. Mm. And even though that I know the person lived because the leg had been removed, they had diabetes and there was gangrene, looking at that detached leg was so disturbing. Aesthetically, it was beautiful. I shot it on this cutting board that they use in the histology lab that under the fluorescent lights turned green. The skin was moist. There was purple and red, and then the white of the bone sticking out of the leg. It was beautiful and very haunting, and one of the only things that I've ever photographed that made me cry.
That's photographer Sarah Sudoff talking about her collection called At the Hour of Our Death. Now, if you want to see some of those photos, you can visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. This hour, we're talking with photographers who use their skill and art to bear witness to human suffering. So how do they themselves deal with what they see or don't see? William Christenberry is a noted American photographer. He spent 4 decades taking pictures of the place he grew up, the back roads and empty shacks of Hale County, Alabama. It's a landscape of economic hardship, but there was one day, one place in particular, where the pain caught up with him.
I had been photographing, actually right up the street from the Barbecue Inn, another country store. And no one was around. It was kind of strange. It was a very quiet day. And I'm under the dark cloth, that is with the big camera, focusing. And I heard no footsteps, nothing. And when I took the cloth off my head, right to my left, it startled me. It didn't scare me, but startled me was this man. And he was beautiful, purple-black skin, as you see so often in African-American people in the Deep South. Purple-black. And he was dressed in a white short-sleeve starch shirt, white starch, white pants, white shoes, freshly polished, and a big wide-brim white hat. And he said to me, "You like that old building, son?" I said, "Yes, sir." "You ought to see my house." More out of courtesy, I said, "Well, sir, when I finish here, I'd be pleased to see your house." So in a few minutes, I'd finished and broke down the camera and put everything in the car. And he got in beside me. And he says, "Just down that road, about 2 miles. And I started down the road. And then I noticed that his left arm was missing from right below the cuff of the shirt, but I didn't say anything. And in a minute, he says to me, "Pull over on the shoulder of the road, son. That's my house. I built that house with one arm." So we got out, and he wanted to show me inside. And we went in the back door, which was fine, little red earth path back to the back door. And then my heart really sank because there was no floor. It was just red earth. And a beat-up old mattress over in one corner, some broken chairs. And we chatted a little while, just made small talk. And I said, "Sir, do you mind if I photograph your house?" He said, "Oh, I'd be so pleased. Yes, please, I would be happy for you to. Please." So I went out and set up the big camera, the 8x10, in front of the house, and I made the picture. And I thanked him and left, thanked him profusely. And I drove away, and when we got back to Washington a week or so later and I saw the proof print, it was okay. Technically, it was sound, properly focused, decently composed, but it did not resonate with what I'd experienced there. Now, let me be the first to say, I don't know if it's possible for me or anyone else to have captured that moment. Maybe a poet, certainly a poet could write about this. So I said to myself, well, I'll go back next year. Next year, pretty much to the same day. I get there and I get out of the car and I start walking down that little red earth path. And a man next door to my right came rushing across the lawn, rushing. And he stopped at the fence edge and he said, "You looking for Mr. So-and-so?" I said, "Yes, sir." "He died. He froze to death last winter." And I've never been able to go back there.
William Christenberry is a noted American photographer. His work has been the subject of solo exhibitions at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, Aperture Gallery, and many others. His most recent book of photographs is called simply William Christenberry. Photographer Michael Nye spent 4 years photographing mentally ill and homeless people in San Antonio, where he lives. He wanted his subjects to have their own voice, so he also recorded their stories.
I think everyone has a wisdom about their own experience. They know something that no one else knows. And so the stories really are about those kinds of wisdoms, what only Jerry experienced or Doris or Beth experienced about their own personal histories.
You mentioned Beth. Now, her childhood experiences left her with permanent post-traumatic stress disorder, and somehow you capture that in your photograph of her. Could you describe it?
She's in a garden. She, growing up, was one of the most talented writers in her high school, and she performed her own songs on stage. So as a child, she was beaten, sexually abused, and she's literally stayed in one chair in her kitchen for years. And in her narrative, she speaks about kindness and the concept of hush and libraries. It's very beautiful. But in the photograph, she's in a garden, and she's standing against a white wall inside corner, and she's standing on ivy. It's thick and green. And although the photograph's in black and white, and I took the picture in late afternoon, and the sun was low, and the wind was blowing, and behind us was a large pecan tree, and so the shadows are, the branches and leaves were constantly in motion. And for me, what was beautiful about the image was the quality of light. There's a glow, white light on white wall, and white on light gray. And Beth is standing in a long dress with her right hand gently holding the side of the wall.
My favorite place to be is a place that I'm most safe. It's a corner in my kitchen, and I've got it fixed up to look like a treehouse. And on my left is a window with plants everywhere, and everything a person would want, books, music, that's in my safe place. I spend 3/4 of my waking life in that safe place. How is it possible to love someone that beats you up, that uses you, that degrades you? I don't understand why a parent would grab a child's hair and twist it around and slam that child into a wall. How a father who's going through a drought of loneliness take one of his children and strip that child of dignity and knowledge and give that child pain. Why would a parent deprive them of food, lock them in a cabinet? Why would that happen? I'd like to wrap my arms around someone, whether my age, older, younger, wrap my arms around someone that is going through this until they finally believe it's not their fault, they're a beautiful person. Kindness is more important than anything else in this world. I think that every philosopher has probably tried to tell us that. That's what it comes down to. What else are we here for but to take care of each other, to nurture the planet? What else are we here for? There's a thing when we're children we experience, it usually exists in libraries, and it's called the hush, like this magic world called hush. There's not many places now to find hush. Sometimes I really do think that if every person would experience hush, even if they almost have to force it on themselves for a while, just the bird, just the wind, nothing else, hush, there would be less violence.
Will you tell me about the photograph of Elizabeth?
I was interviewing Elizabeth about anxiety disorder and agoraphobia, about the fear that she had of leaving her home. And so she called me between interviews. She was trembling, and she said, "I just experienced a panic attack." And so through our conversation, I said, "Is there any way maybe this week you could come over to my studio and maybe go through that experience?" And she was so giving and absolutely agreed. She said, let's try to do that. And it was downtown San Antonio on St. Mary Street. It was late in the afternoon. The photograph's late in the afternoon. It was very busy, lots of traffic and cars. I had my large camera set up. It's an old lens, maybe 80 years old, and it didn't cover the negative, so the image is a circle in the rectangle, and around the circle is black. And Elizabeth is leaning up against the wall, and right as I'm taking the picture, a pedestrian turns the corner, and he's in a blur. Only his foot, or maybe his one arm, is in focus. And listening to Elizabeth's story about a panic attack, it's a reminder that we all have our own separate histories. What about his life? What about hers?
It was a cold morning. It was drizzling. I had an appointment to go downtown that morning, and everything was fine. Just a normal day. When I got on the bus, I went to a favorite spot by the window. The first sensation was there was too much noise, too many notes. All of a sudden, everything is flooding my mind. I don't know why I'm going anywhere. I'm not sure someone's not out to get me. I'm going insane. I feel like everyone's thinking, there's that insane person. All this stuff starts flooding my mind. It's horror. Horror. I can hear and feel my heart pounding like it's knocking on my chest wall. My hands are pretty clammy. I was scared. I was afraid they would be afraid of me. I had no control over my tears, so I got on the floor of the bus so I could hide for a while, hoping this would pass. I was crying. It's just terrifying. So humiliating. No dignity. Afraid to look into anyone's eyes. Then I got interrupted. The bus driver said I needed to get off the bus. "Miss, you need to get off the bus now. You're causing a disruption." I didn't feel like I could move. I was two people. I made myself get up off the floor and slowly walked to the front of the bus and got off. When I got off the bus, there was a telephone pole, and I went over to it and held on to it until I felt stable. That's what it feels like to go through this. That's what a panic attack feels like.
This might be kind of an odd question, having heard how much pain a lot of your subjects have experienced in their lives, but if you could wipe out mental illness tomorrow, would you do so? I guess I'm wondering, is there a function for this kind of sadness, this kind of pain? Do we need these people in some way in our culture?
Well, as I've talked about earlier, the 60 people in the exhibit, I see them as teachers, you know, not as people with mental illness. They are helping us. There is a function. We can understand more about ourselves, more about humanity, the questions that Immanuel Kant asked. So we do need them for understanding, for insight, for courage. I found myself being inspired over and over. So I do think we need to listen to people that have been challenged in their lives. I remember Virginia Woolf's, in her diary, she says that we need to look at the landscapes of our life and we can find that pain and sorrow reveal some truths.
Yes. Oh, yes. I listen to this song over and over and over and over again, as many times as I can. Sometimes 10, 15 hours a day. I feel stronger when I hear the music. I feel normal. Those are the feelings that I have.
Photographer Michael Nye's documentary exhibition is called Fine Line, Mental Health, Mental Illness. So far, it's traveled to more than 30 cities. And if you'd like to see some of those photographs, visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. Chilean-born artist Alfredo Jarre has spent much of his career making art out of human crisis. He creates giant installations, including photography that he takes, and mostly what he's interested in is exploring how huge global crises affect single individuals. His most famous work is called The Rwanda Project. It was 6 years in the making, and Steve Paulson wanted to know why he went to Rwanda.
I felt that the media was not treating this the way it should have been treated. And I was really disgusted by the political reaction, which was no reaction whatsoever. In a moment of sadness, rage, in a moment of insanity, I decided to go.
To go to Rwanda?
To go to Rwanda, to witness the killing, the genocide, to and to express my solidarity.
You went there while the killing was still going on?
I went there at the end of July, early August. So the genocide officially ended in mid-July, so it wasn't that really active at that moment. But what we saw was just the immediate aftermath of the genocide.
I'm wondering how you saw your role in comparison to, I don't know, the way a journalist might approach this, or a documentary filmmaker, people who whose job is to try to render the events that have happened. You are a visual artist. How do you respond to such an immense tragedy?
Yeah, I felt freer, completely freer. I felt at times they were laughing at me because they were walking around with these huge cameras, with huge lenses, normally with two or three cameras hanging from their neck, and I was traveling around with this very little thing that looked absolutely ridiculous. But
with your little camera.
Yeah, my little camera. And but I had the luxury of time, so I've always said that I would prefer to spend 5 hours talking to someone, to a survivor, to try to understand and take a little snapshot with my little camera than covering it the way it was covered with these huge machines taking these spectacular photographs and then running around to the next tragedy. I mean, so I have the luxury of time. And I had no preconceived notions of what I was going to do with this material. I wanted to understand. I wanted to see, to witness. If I could help, I would help. But my mission was to accumulate information. And then later I was going to decide, what can I do with this?
What did you come away understanding? I mean, you spent a lot of time there.
Well, I felt that human beings can do terrible things to each other. This is something I knew, of course, from history, but I had never experienced this in such a vivid and personal way. I went away feeling ashamed of being a human being. I went away wanted to commit suicide because I couldn't believe that as a human being living in the world today, I had allowed this to happen. I felt guilty.
Because, I mean, there were news reports that this was going on while it was going on. And in fact, there were plenty of reports that something terrible was going to happen even before it did.
Absolutely. But fortunately, it was on one hand played down. Second, most media did not use the word genocide, so we would not intervene because, as you know, there's a convention that forces countries to intervene if it is officially a genocide. So the State Department asked not to use that word, and most media complied. The way the media works today, everything is decontextualized. You open a paper, you might find a couple of photographs about this horror. But next to it, you have the new model from Toyota, and then the next page you're invited to take vacations in Hawaii at a great price by this airline. And then you move on. So everything is decontextualized. So an image of pain, of suffering, is drowned in a sea of consumption in the media today. So it's very difficult to affect change through the media the way it is built now.
So what do you do then? I mean, you as an artist coming into this, dealing, I mean, you live in this world of media consumption.
Well, I exchange the large audience that journalists have with time. And I have the luxury of time to work on these projects. And I confront a much smaller audience, but I do it in my own terms. So I can create a space. I can create an experience for the audience where I can tell them a story. And if I succeed, the audience will spend enough time with me, in my hands, listening, watching, understanding, and hopefully they are being illuminated by this story and they will understand what happened and perhaps even move them to action.
I would think one of the things that would be particularly difficult with something like the Rwanda genocide is just the scale. I mean, a million people were killed in a very short period of time, and it's too big to grasp. You know, I mean, how do you sort of scale it down so that we can respond in some way?
Yeah, that's one of the strategies that is key to this project, because if you work only from numbers, then you don't go anywhere. So you had to reduce the tragedy to names, to stories, to personal stories. So my projects did that. I tell the story, specific story of this woman that was attending church with her husband and her two sons and her daughter, and I give names. And I tell what the story of what happened, and then I follow her.
What did happen?
A Hutu death squad came into the church where they had sought refuge, and they killed more than 400 people. And this woman, Gutete Merita, managed to escape miraculously with her daughter, Marie-Louise Uno Mararunga. But her husband and her two sons were killed. And so they hid in a swamp for many weeks, and I found them in that swamp, and then they came out. They were going out that night only in search of food. So she told me her story, and we took her to the hospital in the jeep we had rented. And I spent an entire evening with her, and she told me the story. And my mission was how to tell that story to the world. So basically, I was able to tell the story with one name, one story, with real acts, so I could contextualize it properly.
What did you do with that? I mean, how did you make art out of that?
Well, this particular work with Gutete is called The Eyes of Gutete Merita. And it's one of the most well-known pieces of the series. It consists of a dark space, a hallway, where a story is told in a line of light on one wall. So the letters are illuminated. They are very small, so you have to read them closely. And I tell the story of the genocide, and I tell the story of Gutete. It measures approximately 20 feet long. So you walk along this line of light. And the text ends with me saying, I remember her eyes, the eyes of Gutete Emerita. Then after this, you move to a second space. It's a dark space, in the middle of which you'll find a table, a light table, that is also very big, 18 feet by 22 feet. And this light table is illuminated, of course, and on top of which you find a million slides.
A million slides for the million people killed.
Right. And so you approach these slides, and you realize that on the table, all around, you have loops, magnifiers, inviting you to take a slide and look at it through the loop, like a photographer would do. And you see Gutete's eyes looking at you, the eyes of Gutete that witnessed the genocide that we refuse to see. And then you take another slide, and it's again the eyes of Gutete. Another one, again the eyes of Gutete. So I repeated this image a million times. We have shown this work some 25 times around the world. And the first time we showed it was in Australia. On opening night, the museum guard asked me to come to his security room. He wanted to show me something. And he said, please come. This is in the middle of the opening. I was talking to people outside. And I observed through the security cameras people in the room where the piece is shown. And he said, look at this man or look at this woman, please. And I start looking at them through the security cameras. And I see them looking at the slide through the loop. And then suddenly, they put it in their pocket. These are the eyes of a survivor.
Yeah.
So the curator had come with me because they wanted me to take a decision. Mm-hmm. I said, let me watch. I want to see more. So I spent 30 minutes in this surveillance cabin. And I discovered that the body language of the people, because I was looking at them through a camera from the ceiling, was not the body language of someone who was stealing. I felt they were doing something else, that they were taking with them something like a memento mori, like a memory, something important for them. They were doing it in a different way than stealing. So I took a decision that was not part of the piece. It was not designed like this. I said to the curator, let them do it. Don't say anything. Ask the guards to look the other way. Do not encourage it. Do not mention it. But if people does it, let them do it. So today in 2015, there are more than 17,000 slides in the homes of people around the world.
Wow.
And I feel that they wanted that image.
What I find so interesting about your project is it's kind of counterintuitive, I think. I mean, the obvious thing to do would be, if you want to let people know about the level of atrocity, you show a lot of horrible images. You know, you have museums full of just of people getting butchered by machetes in Rwanda, but you didn't do that.
I felt it was the wrong strategy, and for many reasons, for aesthetical reasons and ethical reasons. The ethical reasons is that I feel and I hope that I can talk about violence without making the victim suffer again that violence. I can talk about poverty without making, with my representations, these people even more poor. So I felt that I didn't want to fall into the trap of this pornography of violence. That imagine the relatives of the victims when they see their loved ones in a newspaper or in a magazine, then they see that many times, and where they have become nothing but corpses.
Alfredo Jarre, talking about one of the installations in his Rwanda Project series. Steve Paulson talked with him. Thanks for listening today. These stories can be hard to hear, but they also matter. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Be well.